Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is The Promise of Tomorrow, where people in industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of The Promise of Tomorrow.
And once again, it's so good to have you back here in the Science News Radio Network. As we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation, today we're going to study the science of the mind, predicting the future. Our guest scientist is John Casty. He's the author of a new book called Mood Matters, and in it he makes the radical assertion that all social events, ranging from trends in popular music and art to the outcome of presidential elections, are based on the attitudes a society holds towards the future. John is going to be just fascinating, and you're going to enjoy every minute of it. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, and we'll visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half of the program. Today, we're going to ask the spirit, I think, a geography question. And, of course, at the end of the program, listeners' comments and the voice of reason. But before today's guest, we're going to step into our world newsroom of the Science News Radio Network and see what's going on worldwide. Here's a word not often seen in a news report. Swinging, S-W-I-N-G-E-I-N-G. I see the notes here. Our staff has found that swinging is an archaic word, has something to do with swindling, and the reason that we ran across it is because it was used by a member of the House of Lords in London, Lord Lawson. Lord Lawson, you probably know, is one of the most prominent skeptical voices in the climate change debate, and he's warned that this is a quote, madness for Britain to try to lead the world in reducing carbon emissions, while Western countries may be prepared to sign up to swinging emission cuts. Lord Lawson used that word, swinging. He believes that emerging nations such as India and China will never agree to them, and it's arrogant of rich countries to ask them to adopt a policy that might limit economic growth, he says. That was reported by Louise Gray of the Daily Telegraph in London. Meantime, President Obama may be softening his push on that cap-and-trade energy bill that passed the House last summer and is now stalled in the Senate. It seems he may be willing to compromise with Republicans in order to get something passed this month. Daniel Stone of Newsweek reports that a GOP senator present at a cabinet room meeting told him that Obama appears prepared to postpone action to one of the country's top CO2 emitters in order to bring a handful of Republicans to his side on the vote. That dust-up over the hidden climate data in Britain seems to be having repercussions in the United States. The U.S. Science Insider reports that scientists seeking funding from the National Science Foundation are going to have to spell out how they plan to manage the data they hope to collect as part of a broader move by the National Science Foundation and other federal agencies here to emphasize the importance of community access to data. And if you followed what happened at Anglia University when the data was not released on climate change, that makes it a little bit more clear. NanoWork News reports at the latest count, this is interesting, over 2,100 companies from 48 countries are now involved in nanotechnology research, manufacturing, or application, a number that keeps growing at a considerable pace. The United States is home to roughly half of all the nanotechnology firms, with more than 1,100 companies. Reports here that 670 companies are in Europe, 230 in Asia, and 210 elsewhere in the world. Okay, we're real close to connecting with today's guest. When we step out of the newsroom, we're going to connect with John Casti in Vienna, Austria. He's a futurist, a scientist, an author of Mood Matters, and he believes that it's the mood of people that create our conditions, not the other way around. And he said that's why it's no accident that futurists of all types, including economists and political analysts, fail at prediction. So you're going to enjoy John. And also, after we get through with John Casti, I want to talk to Paul Lynch. He's the Consul General for Great Britain in Houston, Texas, and I was quite interested as to his opinion of what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico right at the moment. Are the British oil companies, like British Petroleum, you know, they don't want to be called British Petroleum any longer, BP, going to be interested in alternative fuels? And so you'll want to stick around for that after we get off the phone with John Casti. All right, well, we'll step out of the newsroom now and let's connect with our guest in Vienna, Austria.
Stand by.
Okay, now to our guest. Today we have an author, John Casti, who's come out with a new book called Mood Matters, which we're finding pretty fascinating. It's kind of radical, the assertion that all social events, ranging from trends in popular music and art to the outcome of presidential elections, are biased by the attitudes we feel, that we're the ones who kind of create our own future. Do I have that right, John?
Well, I wouldn't say that we actually create our own future. I would say that the mood of the population, namely how do we feel about the future, positive, negative, looking forward, fearing, the attitudes we have toward the future as a group, as a society, not necessarily as individuals, but as a group, bias strongly and impact the character of the kinds of events that we can expect to see.
Well, yeah, and you say it's no accident that futurists of all types, including economists and political analysts, fail in their predictions because they're not taking into account attitudes. Is that right? You really need to explain this for us, John.
Well, I would say that most futurists, they basically are trend followers. Their view of the future is tomorrow's going to be just like today, except a little bit better or a little bit worse, depending on whether we're in an uptrend or a downtrend. And this kind of an attitude is, on the one hand, it's almost always correct, especially if you look on short time scales. But it's useless, because you don't need to be a futurist to basically do trend following. Where the action is, where the money is at the turning points, the places where trends are changing. And so you need to be able to have a procedure to somehow identify when you get into the neighborhood, when you're getting close to a turning point, because that's where things really start happening. And the turning points in the theory that I've presented in my book are impacted and maybe even generated, you might say, by the mood of the population. So you're looking for places where the mood all of a sudden undergoes a major shift from positive to negative or vice versa.
All right. You even say that the rise and fall of great civilizations are based by the attitudes a society holds towards the future. How do you explain that? I mean, that's kind of difficult to fathom.
Well, okay. First of all, my book talks about collective social events, the kinds of events that can only occur when you have a collection of people interacting and giving rise to the event. So it's not about specific individual events like an assassination or a car wreck or something that pertains mostly to an individual. And these collective social events, they can range anywhere from the kinds of films that people like and or fashions that are going to be in style, to the outcome of an election, to the outbreak of a war, to the rise or fall of a civilization. But these kinds of events I've just described have very different timescales. Popular culture things, like the kind of books that people are going to like, this is an event that sort of unfolds over a few weeks to maybe a few months, maybe a year at most. The outcome of an election or a shift of political ideology, that's a kind of medium timescale event. It takes place over a few years, let's say. and then the rise and decline of a civilization, this is a very long time scale event. It unfolds over decades, if not centuries.
Yeah.
So if what you have to understand then is how the social mood itself is changing on different time scales. So, I mean, if I asked you, how do you feel, Colonel, about tomorrow, or how do you feel about the future? The right answer for you to give me would be, which future? How do I feel about tomorrow? How do I feel about next month? How do I feel about next year? Because you may have a different answer for each one of those cases. And so I take this up in great detail in the examples and the methodology that I present in my book. In fact, it's organized along these different time scales. And you have to have ways of characterizing or measuring the social mood on these different time scales, and you have to match that mood with the time scale of the kind of event that you're interested in.
Well, let's say the rise and fall of great civilization, and I want to get into a lot of other things too, but I presume you're speaking about the Roman Empire, or are you talking about the Victorian Age when Britain ruled the waves, or what about those two episodes?
About right now, today, the USA Empire. That's also in the process of, I mean, empires are always changing. You can talk about the Romans if you like. I like the modern era a little bit better because that's the part that we're part of and that we have the most familiarity with and also, to be truthful, have more data for. But yes, those older empires like the British Empire or the Roman Empire or the Turkish Empire or whatever, it's the same phenomena. It's exactly the same processes are at work. These empires rise and fall as the members of the population that composes the empire, as their attitudes toward the future shift from positive to negative and back again on the appropriate long-term timescale associated with the movement of an actual empire. I mean, it wouldn't do you any good if you wanted to understand how empires are moving on or off center stage to look at how the social mood is changing on a day-to-day basis. That's much too short a time scale for the phenomena of change of an empire. But it's just the right time scale for something like the kind of fashions that are going to be in style this year.
Yeah, and I guess the empire thing is so fascinating to me personally because it does take such a long period of time. And of course, at one time, the British Empire, you know, during the Victorian Age, that was the empire. And are you saying then that over a period of time, the attitude of the British public caused the decline in the British Empire and not the other way around?
That's right. Exactly what I'm saying is that it's the internal psychology, you might call it, the attitudes that the people in the society, the Romans or the British or Americans now, have toward the future on these longer timescales that drive the kinds of events that you can expect that are more likely to happen than not. I'm not saying that these things are guaranteed that they're going to happen in a certain way. It's more like weather forecasting. At any given time, many things are possible, but they're not all equally likely. And so my story is to give you some insight into how to weight your bets, if you like, on what's more or less likely.
Well, I guess we reporters are constantly reminding people that in election years, if the economy is really bad, then the incumbents are in serious trouble. We seem to be seeing that currently with in the United States, with incumbents being thrown out of office. And then now there's predictions about whether Barack Obama will survive his first term. What do you see there if you were going to make some sort of a prediction? Do you think there'll be...
In fact, I've already made that prediction, and you'll see it in my book. First of all, you'll see a story there about U.S. presidential elections. And in the entire history of the United States, whenever the mood of the population is negative at the time of the election, the incumbent, or at least the incumbent's party, gets kicked out of office. There's not a single exception. And a couple of years ago, before the most recent presidential election, my friends here in Austria asked me, they said, well, who do you think is going to win the election? Is it be the Democrats or the Republicans? What's going to happen? And I said, oh, this is a very easy call. the Democratic candidate, whoever it will be, wasn't even settled at that time, will win in a landslide. It'll be an easy victory for the Democrats. They could run Mickey Mouse and they would win, because the social mood in America was very downbeat, and that mood has to find an outlet somehow. And the outlet is essentially focused on the incumbent or his or her party, and they always get kicked out. And I also forecast at the time that I actually felt a little bit sorry for poor Mr. Obama, because I felt that the overall mood was so negative, and it certainly hasn't changed, in fact it's gotten even more negative, that he would be held accountable for it, and that he was very likely to be a one-term president, and I stand by that today. I think that, but of course, it's still a long time until 2012, and if the mood somehow miraculously shifts back to the positive by the fall of 2012, then maybe he'll sneak into another term. But I wouldn't bet that way right now.
Well, that's a fascinating way of looking at things, and of course, what you're saying then, If Barack Obama and John Roberts hadn't been as successful as they were in the primaries, that Hillary Clinton would undoubtedly have been elected the first woman president of the United States. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, in fact, I said at the time, I said that, you know, after the election, I said that the biggest winner in this election was Mrs. Clinton, because she didn't get nominated.
Oh, that means she still has a chance then to come back at another time, you think?
Any of the heat, exactly. She didn't have to take. And poor Barack Obama, he's really getting a lot of heat, and a lot of it is he's just paying for the sins of his predecessors, and the bad press, if you like, that he's going to get, for the most part, has nothing to do with him. It has to do with the fact that the population is very unhappy. The incumbent is just, after all, he's one guy. He can't change the world by himself. And he has to, that unhappiness, that negative mood, if you like, finds an outlet in the guy who's in charge. He has to, it happens on his watch, so he has to take the heat.
And you gauge all this because you study happy songs. A happy public pushes happy songs up the charts. A depressed public pushes depressing songs up the charts. Are you seeing a lot of depressing music right now? Is that how you're coming to the conclusion that we're all depressed, or are you using other gauges?
Well, first of all, I'm not looking at the music, if you like, is it's a consequence. It's not a cause. It follows from a period of positive or negative mood, the qualitative character of the music. But the way that I characterize and advocate actually measuring the social mood is a very simple one. It's just look at the financial market averages. The Dow Jones Industrial Average or the S&P 500 Index, these are what I call sociometers. These market indices, they represent the bets that people are making about the future on all time scales. And the markets are a very effective way of taking all of these different bets, from people who are making short-term bets, you know, sort of day traders, to people who are making long-term investments and everything in between, and synthesizing all of those bets into a single number, a change of price. And so I look in my book at alternative ways of measuring social mood and examine the pluses and minuses of them, and the conclusion at the moment is that the best sociometer, is what I call it, that we currently have is the financial market indices. It's not perfect. I want to hasten to mention that. It's not perfect, but it's a very good way of gauging the social mood, and it exists on all time scales. You can look at those averages on a daily basis or a monthly basis or a quarterly basis or an annual basis, so you can get the picture of how the social mood is unfolding on different time scales from looking at those financial market indices.
I'm glad you got into the financial part of this, John, because, of course, we all believe, or at least I did until now, that productive economy makes people optimistic and that an unproductive economy makes us pessimistic. But you say the opposite is true, that optimistic people make a productive economy and pessimistic people make an unproductive one. Now, that's pretty hard to swallow. We're looking right now at a worldwide economic downturn. I mean, we know what's happening here in the United States because we feel it every day, but a lot of us don't realize it's happening all over Europe too. France is in a bad situation, and Greece and Italy, we're hearing about it all over the place. Is the whole world pessimistic and causing the bad economy? Is that what you're saying?
Well, first of all, it's not the whole world. The Asians aren't depressed at all. So you're displaying a rather North American Eurocentric view of the whole situation.
Okay.
Leaving that aside, fundamentally, I think you have to separate out the financial world from the actual economic world. The financial world, of course, it has to do with equities, commodities, financial market asset classes. But the economy has to do with broader macro or economic phenomena like unemployment rates, balance of payments, these kinds of things. These are the economy. And it's been well known for quite a long time that what the financial markets do today gives you insight into what the macroeconomy is going to be doing tomorrow. The financial markets are a leading indicator of macroeconomic trends and phenomena. So if you use the financial markets as your measure of social mood, then you immediately conclude the social mood is actually a leading indicator of macroeconomic trends like unemployment rate. So it's no surprise to me to see that when the financial markets, namely the social mood, how people feel about the future, the bets they make on the future, is negative, then you get, as a consequence, declining macroeconomic numbers. So this is, and I in the book Mood Matters, you'll see this laid out in very great detail with lots of pictures, as well as lots of arguments for how this phenomenon repeats itself regularly.
It seems like the phenomenon that you're talking about is a self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, if all of us are sad and in a bad mood, we're causing more bad things to happen, and if all of us are happy and in great moods, we can cause better things to happen. And then what does that say for being able to control our moods and making good things happen all the time?
Well, first of all, it would be a self-fulfilling prophecy if there were feedback directly from events that happen to the actual social mood. And a lot of people believe, in fact almost everybody believes, but that believes that events, whether change of unemployment rate or something of that, events actually feed back and cause people to feel more positive or more negative. And in fact, it's such a widespread belief that that must be the case that nobody ever even really questions it. It's just taken as an assumption that that's the way the world works. Well, in fact, this is something that I take up in painstaking detail in this book, because there's not a single piece of evidence to support it other than the fact that everybody seems to believe it. And in fact, what actually seems to be the case is just the opposite. There's no feedback at all. That essentially you could even say that events don't matter. What matters is the internal dynamics of how the social mood is generated from a collection of individuals and how it changes. And nobody actually really understands that process very well at all. It's a little bit like the way a epidemic might emerge in a population of people through individuals who get sick and pass it on to somebody else, and then eventually it dies out. But it's very unclear theoretically how this process actually works.
Well, I've been given the cue. We have to take a break, but we'll be back to expand more on that thought right after this. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers. where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who, in the den of strangers, will we meet today?
Anonymous. There are two times when we should keep our mouths shut, when we swim and when we're angry. Anonymous.